welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 581 for Wednesday, the 17th of October, 2018. And joining me this evening on the line is Mr. Dave Neal. Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Andrew, how are you? I'm back again. There must have been a BSB race on this weekend.
It's funny you should mention that. Because just this weekend, indeed there was. And that's one of the things we'll be talking about on the show. We'll have our usual rapid roundup of road racing news. We'll be briefly covering round 12, the penultimate World Superbike race from the new El Villicum circuit in Argentina. And of course, we'll be touching on the final round of the British Superbike Championship, the triple header from Brands Hatch in deepest, darkest Kent. But first things first, let's jump into some news and some MotoGP news. It came out this week that Takumi Nakagami has been given a new deal for 2019. He'll be riding alongside Cal Crutchlow at LCR at least for another year. So this means, I think, for MotoGP, we've only got the Tito Rabat bike still waiting to be officially confirmed if it's him for the 2019 Aventia ride. Other than that, I think the rest of the MotoGP grid is all sewn up for 2019.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think they're waiting, obviously, on Tito's injuries and his recovery after his crash at Silverstone MotoGP that didn't happen. But for Taka Nakagami, that's a good little capture for him to take that seat for a second season. He hasn't done particularly bad this year. The Honda isn't the easiest bike out there to ride, that's for sure. But I think another season will do in the world of good. And if he can regularly break into the top 10, I think that, I don't think he's going to be a particularly a support rider to Cal Crutchlow, as in, pushing him for positions, but for the team and for sponsor visibility into the top 10 on a regular basis should suit him down to the ground.
Yeah, agreed. And then in some of the MotoGP smaller classes, in Moto2, for example, the Angel Nieto team has confirmed its Moto2 lineup for 2019. They've signed the Andorian rider Xavier Cardalus, and he'll be partnering British rider Jake Dixon, who will be both riding KTMs for next year.
That's another good one. We like that. I'm really keen to see how Jake goes. I don't know much about his teammate, but certainly it's going to be quite a level playing field for a lot of them, for all of the Moto2 field next season with the new bike. So hard to say how anybody's going to go at this early stage, but once the field's confirmed and we get the first couple of tests and practices out of the way, we'll be able to shake down early in the new year on that one.
And the other Moto2 news was the SAG Racing team has signed Tetsutsa. I'm going to mash this. I'll
give you my didn't best. Practice this before we started.
Tetsuta Nagashima.
Yeah, that'll do.
Remy Gardner. Actually, I get Remy Gardner pretty well. Remy Gardner.
Not to be confused with Remy Martin.
Exactly. Both riders have been signed for the 2019 and 2020 Moto2 seasons with this team. This is good to see. I think there's a pretty decent teammate for Remy Gardner, someone who can help to together develop the bike and push him as well. So we knew it sounds like it was going to be a Kalex frame, Olin suspension. So with the new Triumph engine as well, I think that's going to give him a pretty good start into 2019.
Yeah, it's good, especially for Remy. He's blossoming on the Moto2 bike. He's working hard this year, coming back from his two broken legs in a motocross crash earlier in the year. Somebody's obviously seen potential in him somewhere, which he's been threatening for a while now. And it always seems to be a little bit harder when you're carrying a name at the same time. Similar to Dakota Mamala when he was riding the CEV in the smaller classes, but he now works for Alpine Stars. But it's never easy when you're carrying a world famous name. So, good luck to Remy for next season. I'll be keeping a keen eye on how he goes.
And then in Moto3, we had some news that the CIP Green Power team has teamed up with the FIM CEV Repsol Moto3 Junior World Championship rider Tom Booth Amos. They'll be partnering for their 2019 Moto3 season.
Interesting one, this, because I'm still not 100% sure on what Tom Booth Amos's level is. He smoked everybody last year in Moto3. His results have been fairly decent in CV, but I'm sure I read that he'd been out with a broken wrist at some point this season.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I think, you know, CEV and CIV are the natural feeders into the World Moto3 Championship. I mean, I'm always encouraged when I see that these sort of feeder series are working, that there is a viable path through these junior feeder series into the main one. So,
Absolutely. It's great to see another Brit in there. That's, you know, positive spin. I wasn't being disrespectful to Tom Boothamos. I don't know what his true pace is as regards to a Moto3 GP level at the moment.
And it's always going to be difficult as he comes in to start riding potentially circuits that he's not ridden before. So, you know, it's one of those things. We'll just have to see how he goes through the year. But
sure,
wish him a good season.
Absolutely, 100%.
And there was some news to say that Moto3 rider Nicolò Barriga, unfortunately, will be missing out on this weekend's Japanese Grand Prix and probably the following round at Phillip Island as well. It was mentioned he suffered a domestic injury, which needed surgery to fix some tendons in his right hand. I have no more information than that. And domestic was given to me in quotes. So I don't know if that was a domestic with the missus that left him with an injury.
I have such a shallow sense of humour.
Or if that was just an injury in a domestic setting. Anyway.
Move on.
Moving right along.
Get well soon, Nicolò Barriga. Get well soon.
But it sounds like they might, I think, draft in Celestino Vetti Ramos to make a debut. I think he's going to be running with them in 2019, but it sounds like he'll get the opportunity to debut at Motegi.
VR46 Academy rider, CIV rider, possibly? I know nothing about him, I'm assuming.
It is a Sky VR46, so yeah, okay. I think they've got more than one or two substitutes on the bench, I think, when it comes to...
They really
to,
have, haven't they?
They've got depth and breadth. And for next year, for Grassini, it's going to be Gabriel Rodrigo will be headlining an all-new Grassini lineup in the next year's Moto3. Jorge Martin and fellow championship contender, as we know, Fabio Giantonio, both moving up to Moto2. So Grassini has signed up Rodrigo, and also he'll be racing alongside the rookie Riccardo Rossi.
Ah, excellent. He's going to be a challenger next season, I think. Notorious for inconsistency, I think, for Rodrigo. But it's certainly full of talent. And I think he will be amongst the contenders for next season in Moto3 for sure.
Yeah, and a good team as well. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So there was World Superbike, as we mentioned, from Argentina. And there was a little bit of news and there was a little bit of lack of news. I think one of the pieces of news that was interesting was the fact that World Superbike organisers were confirming that they will be doing a three-race format for 2019, sticking with the current Saturday race and Sunday race, but introducing a sprint race, supposedly Sunday morning.
Yeah, that makes sense, because if they're dropping, I think we spoke about it on the show previously, if they're dropping the European Superstock 1000 series, there's a yawning chasm in the program that needs to be filled.
Yeah.
If they're not replacing it with another series, you have Supersport 300, you have Supersport 600s, and you have World Superbikes. Unless the local countries do their own stock support races, as happens at Donington on occasion, the Stock 1000s or the Stock 600s. So, yeah, that makes sense. And it gives Johnny Ray a chance to have an even bigger points win.
The thing that surprised me is they made this announcement, and of course, instantly, everybody was going like, oh, okay, so how do you decide the grid for the Sunday sprint race? And does the Sunday sprint race decide the grid for race two? And they had no answers.
You would think that qualifying would sort race one, fastest laps, because they're doing away with reverse grid, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. They're losing the reverse grid for the second race. But I guess to come out with the announcement not having formalized, finalized, it just seemed a bit premature.
Yeah.
So I can see the point. It's like someone announcing a party without saying like what the venue is, what the dress code is, or whether you should bring any food or not.
No, that's true. That's true. But I would surmise that they would take a leaf out of British Superbike's book and have qualifying for race one and then the following two races by lap times for the race prior.
Like I say, it's all guesstimate for right now, but it seemed funny that they would come out with this so early without it being fully baked.
Unless they're going to draw lots.
Keys from a helmet.
Back to the Pro-Am days.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll have to see how that shakes out. And I guess the other thing from my standpoint was still the lack of news. You know, we just talked about MotoGP seats pretty much all sewn out. There's a sort of raft of last-minute Moto3, Moto2 announcements. But when you look for World Superbikes, the lack of news, given the fact that Marco Melandri still doesn't have a confirmed seat, Javier Forres seems to be out at the Barney Racing, Loris Baz, still knows news. Tom Sykes, I still haven't heard any real concrete rumours or news as to where and if he'll be riding next year.
No, it's a very, very strange way of doing it. I don't understand why everything is so quiet. When you think if the series is struggling the way that it is, excuse me while I fiddle with my headphones, if the series is struggling on the surface, the way that it is, you would think that there would be a bigger effort made via social media, via all channels, to make World Superbikes even more at the track. World Superbikes is accessible. There's no doubt about it. It's open paddock at Donington Park. You can wander in, you can see the guys, you can see the team, the staff, everything else, the hospitality units, and you feel a part of it. No question. That side is fabulous. But when you've only got 15,000 people coming through the gate, there's your issue. Now, I don't know what the TV audiences are like, what the viewing figures are like through Eurosport or via the video pass. But you would think, and when you look on social media, you click on their links on World Superbike, you have to log in to watch the videos. 75, 80, 90% of the people who click on that link are going to go, fuck that, I'm not logging in, I'll move on to the next story.
Yeah.
You know, and it whereas if you do that with MotoGP, they're putting out free videos all the time.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, for example, the GoPro laps I know that Crayfar does, they're normally free to view, and a whole host of other things, including some snippet interviews and other bits and pieces, you know. Is it just a demonstration of the content that is there that helps you understand, going, oh, you know what, there could be some value in registering to see some more and then ultimately making the final purchase? Yeah.
How can the same company have vastly different views on social media for two different race series unless they don't particularly want to?
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely still some sort of news to come out of that and some stuff to sort out. We'll have to see how that goes. Did you get to see any of the World Superbike racing from El Velicum in Argentina?
Actually, yes. I think so. I say they wait long enough. I'm being really harsh on World Superbikes, I'm sorry.
We have a ton of BSB to get through, so I'm just going to give you the 5-cent tour of World Superbike from Argentina, which is kind of a shame, because I have to say the circuit looked properly nice. Good track, beautiful scenery, and congratulations to them for getting that finishing time, because they were catching a lot of flack early on that they weren't going to get that done. And I think the feedback was fairly comprehensive that it was done on time and done well.
Yeah, I think to a man, everybody was so impressed with the location, with the layout of the track. Certainly watching from on my sofa, it looks a fantastic place to be. And I know I'm being hard on World Superbikes, and most of the motorcycling public are. It's difficult to get excited when you've got a rider winning 10 races on the trot, you know, and it's difficult to be as positive as we can be about it. I'd love to see World Superbikes back at the forefront. I'd love to see more riders in there, but that's not going to happen until more manufacturers come in and spend similar money to what Kawasaki are doing. I don't think it's about handicapping Kawasaki. I think it's trying to get everybody else up to that same level, which is going to be difficult because they throw millions at it. Hopefully the new V4 Ducati will change that, and Bautista, and obviously Leon Haslam coming in as well. But that remains to be seen. But is there a sportsman at the moment as on top of their game as Johnny Ray is? Take nothing away from him.
Yeah, and we'll touch on that as we get through the races. I mean, coming in, we already know that Johnny Ray had won the championship. So the races were for second, third place. Davis was second, Vandermark third in the championship. I mean, there's 26 points between Davis and Vandermark. Sykes was trailing another 36 points behind in third. So I guess it was for those sort of remaining places, and potentially for these riders that we touched on who don't have confirmed seats for next year, to put themselves in the shop window and to kind of show other teams, you know, what they're missing and what their services could mean to them for next year.
Sure.
Super Bowl I was interesting because, in actual fact, Tom Sykes had to go through Super Bowl I alongside Vandermark on the Yamaha. Those were probably the two people you wouldn't necessarily expect to be in there. And Tom Sykes did duly go through Super Bowl I and Vandermark in second. Baz was in third, Jake Gagne in fourth there. So for Super Bowl II, it was between really the Ducatis and Johnny Ray. Marco Melandri was able to sneak a pole spot, but Johnny Ray was right behind him, about 0.4 seconds behind. Eugene Laverty having a decent showing on the Aprilia in third. Tom Sykes was able to drag himself up to fourth. And Javier Forres in fifth on the Barney Racing Ducati. And he went on to have a pretty strong showing in race one.
He did.
It was... you know, we knew it was a new track. We knew it was going to be a dirty track. The World Superbikes were literally the first people to be racing there in anger. So during free practice one and free practice two, you know, and over those first few days, we got a fairly narrow sort of racing line that got rubbered in. So we knew even in race one, passing was going to be a little bit difficult. There definitely were places and opportunities on the circuit, but you had to step offline and to get onto the dirty part of the track to do it. So the other thing I noticed too was a pretty interesting first corner as well. And it was the first corner that Johnny Ray was able to slip past Marco Melandri, keep his position into second corner, and he was off. And basically that was it for race one. I mean, he was off into the lead. I think he managed to accumulate something like a 9-second lead by the time they eventually crossed the line. There was a little bit of racing to be had sort of like, you know, further down the order between Toprak, Forres and Eugene Laverty. Toprak finished in third, pretty impressive. Javier Forres in fourth and Eugene in fifth. The Aprilia seemed to go quite well. I don't know if the, you know, the gearing that had been set at the beginning of the year just happened to click and suit them for this track. Unfortunately, Salvadori crashed out in race one, so we didn't get to see really how both Aprilias went. Other retirements were Chaz Davis, Jake Gagne. So coming into race two, I guess we were expecting a repeat of race one. We had the reverse grid. We had Johnny Ray starting from ninth. But we learnt at the beginning of Sunday morning that Johnny Ray was not feeling quite himself. It sounds like he'd spent most of the night hugging the toilet, being rather poorly.
Yeah, you hear that as well, don't you, from the MotoGP guys that have been out to Argentina. There often is a case of food poisoning somewhere in the paddock for some reason, whether it's local food or however it's been caught. There just seems to be that the danger of food poisoning out in South America, and unfortunately Jonathan Ray got a huge bout of it over Saturday night. As you say, hardly any sleep, very very drained, loss of hydration. He was in a heck of a mess. For me, it had been a day off work.
Yeah, for sure. But Johnny, starting on ninth, right from the get-go, his usual form of trying to push really, really hard to make up the places, and within a lap or two, he was already up to fifth. But I think he pushed a little bit too hard too early, had a few wobbles and a few near misses.
He actually looked ragged for the first time this year.
He did. I thought he was pushing a bit too hard there. So you definitely saw him sort of pause, take a breath. And he slipped back down to about seventh at one point. And then I think once he got settled in, he just sort of went on his way. And sure. Took a lap or two, went after Forres, who at that point had got into the lead with about a 3-second lead or so. Laverty was there in second, looking pretty good, but unfortunately crashed out early on. And it was Ray who made his way past the squabbling Ducatis of Chaz Davis and Marc Melandri. And Lowe's as well had a decent start. He started through the race sort of just slowly fading back, each bike coming up and taking him without too much of a fight.
Didn't really have the machine to fight back with, did he?
No, I don't think so. But I know if there was a good portion where you thought like Forres might be able to just you know, keep the pace up. But once Johnny Ray got past Toprak and started to close down Forres, I mean, I think he was making up like about half a second, 0.7 a lap. And it didn't take him long to eventually come through past Forres. And then again, he just sort of went off into the lead, ultimately crossing the line with some sort of 3.5 second gap. And he was popping wheelies for the last half of that last lap.
He was. But that's That's where the level that Jonathan Rea is at the moment. He can, as you say, he paused, he reset himself because he was looking ragged in the early days, as you say, in the early laps, took a breath and like, right, let's go again. He knows that he's got 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 in his locker that he can bang out lap after lap with relative ease, even when he's under the weather. You know, I wonder maybe for Qatar if they'll let him use fifth and sixth gear as well. So, you know, you can't take anything. It's not the most spectacular sport to watch. But again, in the times of Casey Stoner's dominance and Marc Marquez's dominance of 10 wins in MotoGP a couple of three seasons ago, you miss watching a master at work. And it's important to watch what Jonathan Rea is doing. I don't have a World Superbike representative sat next to me prodding me saying, be nice about World Superbikes or Jonathan Rea. It just, people can get lost in thinking, oh, for God's sake, he's doing it again and this and that and the other. It's not great for TV viewers sat at home. It's great to watch someone at the top of the game and just understand how well he is riding that motorcycle. And it's not a joy to watch, but it's really, really impressive. Does that make sense?
I know what you mean. I mean, I did sit there and just, you know, especially race one, when he's stretching out a 9-second lead, just watching him ride, knowing that essentially there, even Toprak is basically on equivalent machinery.
Yeah.
You know, as his teammate Tom Sykes, as are a lot of the other Kawasaki's on the grid. But just, you know, it's like a masterful individual demonstration. Unfortunately, you had to go back like four or five places to actually find anybody racing each other. And if you're there to, you know, depends, you turn up to watch a race or sort of a masterful demonstration. And a couple of laps, a masterful demonstration, you know, I really, really enjoy that. It's like watching Top Flight Ballet or something like that. But after a while, I kind of get a bit itchy and I just want to watch a bit of a punch up.
So it needs to be the last couple of laps that you watch that. Similar to Leon Haslam this weekend. If you do the battle bit first, make your way to the front, and then if you've got the legs in the last couple of laps, then just show how to lead from the front. I mean, obviously that's a textbook race. A textbook win for a motorcycle racer is to get out front as quickly as possible and be the first one home by the longest distance possible. So he's doing his job.
Not taking anything away from him. And I think we'll talk a lot more about this when we do the, you know, talk about the last race in Qatar. But essentially he crossed the line first. So now, I mean, the numbers now just start writing themselves with the 16th race win of the season. I think this took him to just one victory from equaling the all-time record for wins in a single season, which was currently held by, or is currently held by Doug Polan on 17. Yes. And he also went on to equal Carl Fogarty's records of 55 wins with one manufacturer. I think there were some other records in there as well, but I wasn't quick enough to scribble them all down.
10 in a row. Was he the first man to do that?
He did do 10 in a row, first one. Not sure. I think he might have either equaled or eclipsed Hodgson. Not sure.
Good point. We'd have to look on that one for Qatar. Yeah. That's something to look to.
My elderly brain is. But it was him who took the win. It was Javier Forrest, a man who is not riding, who seems to have been bumped out from Michael Ruben Rinaldi for next year. Marco Melandri in third, a man, as we mentioned, still not having a ride for next year. Chaz Davis on the other Ducati in fourth. Decent ride for Chaz, considering I know he's still riding a little bit injured.
Yeah, he's still injured with the collarbone. Did he break it mountain biking or cross training, something? Yeah.
Tom Sykes was there in fifth. Tom seemed to have a fairly steady run. He didn't seem to really get any faster, but he didn't seem to get any slower. People just seemed to sort of drift backwards past him, was my impression. One of those being Alex Lowe's finishing in sixth. Toprak, who had a decent run in race two, actually. He was running up the front for most of the race, but he just seemed to lose some rear grip, I think, towards the end, and just unfortunately got drifted back, ended up in seventh. Salvatore on the other Aprilia in eighth. And yeah, unfortunately, Laverty went out, I think, lap two pretty early. Kamiya was out as well in the Red Bull Honda. Yeah, so again, not even really a good run for the Hondas either. Although Gagne had a decent finishing in 10th.
Yeah, that might be too little too late for Jake, though. I can I can see him heading back to the States after this season. I don't think he's done quite enough to remain with the team. I could be proved wrong, but at this point in time, I think both the team and probably Jake himself was expecting a little bit more from the season.
Yeah, agreed. So at the end of that, I mean, the standings are all pretty much the same. Davis and Vandermark second and third, Slyke still in fourth. I mean, the gaps close marginally, but we'll have to see how it goes. We've got one more round in Qatar in 2 weeks' time. And then we'll do a bit more of a review, a autopsy, or whatever you want to call it, after that. And hopefully we'll have a little bit more news about what the format of the race weekends are going to be for 2019. But let's talk British Superbikes, because we were treated, I have to say, thanks to the rain, with a pretty amazing weekend of racing, quite apart from the fact that we actually did get to see, finally, Lian Haslam lift the British Superbike Championship trophy.
Absolutely so. I wasn't there this weekend. Our last trip was Alton Park, but I really paid close attention, as you would expect, as I do every weekend, to free practice and qualifying and everything that's going on, and trying to pick up on any little tidbits that I can from across the weekend. But I mean, it was almost anything can happen in racing, but it was almost as close to a foregone conclusion as possible that Lian Haslam would lift his first British Superbike crown at Brands Hatch this weekend. I think, let me have a look. I thought I'd made a note on this one, but I can't remember if I did. Even if Lian did a repeat of 2017 and failed to finish in the points in three races. Did he finish in the points last year? I can't remember. But certainly at Silverstone, he did three DNFs. It would mean that Jake had to win twice and finish fifth.
Yeah, it was a mathematical possibility, wasn't it?
It was mathematically possible.
But it was kind of like an extremely marginal.
Yeah,
I remember listening to Jack Burnicle and Jamie Witt trying to do all the math calculations, and it was just highly unlikely to almost impossible.
Sure. And if Jake didn't win the first race, then it was almost likely that Lian Haslam would finish close enough to him. He knew he had, as long as he could see him, he would win the championship, as long as Jake didn't win the race. Because the 25 points to 20 points gap wouldn't have given him enough to have the overall victory before Sunday. So it was an interesting one, certainly for Saturday. There's an awful lot on the line, an awful lot of tension after qualifying, Qualifying was fairly eventful itself, wasn't it?
Yeah, agreed. And the great thing is Saturday, at least it was warm and dry, a little bit blustery, a little bit windy. But that was good to see. But yeah, one of the things, for example, I saw for qualifying Q1, Josh Elliott, very unlucky not to get through to Q2. I think he kind of missed it by about 0.1. I think his teammate Gino got to go through.
He did. He missed it by 0.1 on about 30 seconds that he was in the... He was in 17th place, and then unfortunately he just got bumped out by Michael Laverty, and then obviously and Gino Rey as well. No Dan Linfoot for qualifying. He took part in FP1 and FP2, but he was still too battered and beaten from his pretty horrible incident at Assen when he got run over by Glenn Irwin. So that's Dan Linfoot out for the weekend, and as far as I know, I believe is out of Honda as well. He's now looking for a ride for next season. I think there's going to be two new faces at Honda for next season, but again, we'll wait for confirmation on that. But speaking of Jason O'Halloran, he caused his motorcycle, should I say, caused quite a bit of an issue over qualifying, didn't it?
It did. It sounded like they had either engine let go, or it just definitely had some issues, but it ended up dropping some oil on a quite a bit of the track, didn't it?
It was a good length of the track. He fell off in Q1, but he'd already put in a time that would take him into Q2 anyway. He was into the 125s. He low-sided off at Graham Hill Bend, the left-hander after Druid. So you'd been on the right-hand side of the tyre for an awful long time before you switch back to the left. And it's a notorious place for losing the front. just no heat in the left-hand side of the tyre, and it many, many, many people have gone down at Graham Hill Bend over the years. So it was back to the garage for O'Halloran, and he'd made it into Q2. The team had quite a bit of repair work to do. But unfortunately, when he went out for Q2, as the cameras followed the guys round, Jessup went down on his outlap. He went down at Graham Hill Bend. Brad Ray came straight back in, complaining that there was oil on the front and the rear tyre. Luke Mossy went down at Graham Hill Bend. Jake Dixon went down at Druids. And it turned out that it was fluid from Jason O'Halloran's rebuilt bike that unfortunately was dropping, whether it was oil, coolant, whatever it was, onto the circuit. But it was a fine mist. As Whit was explaining on the TV commentary, they say there's 100 PSI. Is it 100 PSI of pressure for the oil through the engine while it's running? Something like that. I'm sure that's along those lines. The engineers, such as yourself, will understand that more than I do, because I go a bit misty and foggy when people talk about engine internals and the such like. It caused quite a bit of consternation from that. Out of Q1, we lost Christian Idden, Josh Elliott, as you said, Mason Law, Fraser Rogers, Sylvain Barrier, Dean Harrison, Joe Francis, Sean Winfield, Danny Kent, who was confirmed with the Mavuno.com Halsall Racing Suzuki team for the weekend. Never ridden the superbike before. He had a test in the week at Brands Hatch, but that was only around the Indy circuit, so he didn't have an awful lot of time to get used to A, a 1000cc superbike, B, a production bike, and C, Pirelli tyres. So an awful lot for Danny to get his head round this weekend. He qualified 26 into the 127s. So, you know, he certainly didn't embarrass himself. It's kind of about where I expected he would be to start with, because he'd only had three sessions on track prior to that on the full GP circuit. So an awful lot to learn for Danny Kent there. As we go into Q2, after all the guys had fallen down and done what they'd done, you can in qualifying, once the bike has been rescued, been picked up by the marshals, there's a quick check over by the Orange Army, and you can then ride back to pit lane via the scrutineering bay. Can't do that in a race. Once the bike goes down on its side in the race, that's it. You are out. You are finished. But in qualifying, once the bike's been checked over, you are allowed to ride it back to pit lane to have remedial repairs done, but obviously via scrutineering first to make sure there's nothing serious, engine casing cracks, things like that. So, and you're not dropping fluid everywhere. So that really helped the guys that had gone down, especially for Jake Dixon, who was able to put a time in to take him through into Q3. I was calling it Q1. They really should go Q3, Q2, Q1, because one has a higher status for me. Does that make sense? I often get that wrong.
I understand what you're saying, but I always think about this happened first, this happened second, then this happened third.
That makes a huge amount of sense, but then not a lot makes sense to me sometimes.
Yeah, but it was good to see them after the red flags and having them cleaned up. I think, you know, you saw them when they came out for the second part of Q2. You could definitely see that cement line, yes, like you see through Graham Hill there too.
Absolutely.
It's always wonderful when they do put the cement dust down. You know, as someone who rides on track, it really, really helps you figure out, you know, where to go, where to avoid, especially initially until you've had a few bikes through that to sort of figure out exactly how much grip there is.
Don't want to be the first one over it, do you?
No. Always give that stuff a bit of a wide margin.
After you, Claude. You can check that first. Thanks very much.
And I did notice around Q2, it looked like the Poolbird Motorsport Ducatis were back to their old tricks of Glenn giving Andrew a little bit of a toe.
Yeah, very much so.
Did you see that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had to smile. But, you know, why not? As we said before, that they're teammates, they're brothers, so they're going to do it. And, you know, we're great friends. I would pull you around, which is unlikely. You'd pull me around more the point on a motorcycle. But yeah, it's understandable, and some are quite warm to a little bit more to Andy Irwin this weekend. Very impressed with the young fella and what he's doing. But yeah, for the PBM team, yeah, they were riding in formation, which is their last weekend for the team anyway, for both of them, as both of them departed after Sunday's race. So, you know, they were doing the best for themselves. James Ellison, usual kind of finishing position for him in 11th place. Jason O'Halloran just missing out. Bradley Ray struggling again. And this is what kind of makes me scratch my head a little bit about re-signing for the build-based team for next year. Hopefully they have something in mind and a plan just to get that bike back to where Bradley Ray needs it for it to be able to work. Suzuki obviously think an awful lot of Bradley Ray. They're taking him out to Suzuka for the last round of the All Japan Superbike race in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously he was 10th at Suzuka there this year for his first time out there. So the company were very impressed with him. And to take him out there for that is a great thing for Bradley Ray. Try and finish the season on a high and try and salvage a little bit more confidence after what was another relatively difficult weekend in the British Superbike Championship for him.
Yeah, agree, because, we'll see later on, his teammate Cooper had a pretty good weekend.
Yeah, who hasn't got a ride for next season and who's ridden his arse off this weekend? Fair play to him. Oh, sorry, that was a big pause, wasn't it?
That's okay. Moving on.
Wow. The bear walks into the bar, orders a drink, and he goes, I'll have a pint, please. Barman says, why the big pause? Anyway, that's a poor one. Emily would like that one. I'm not quite delirious yet, but that 4:45 alarm will take its toll at some point. But over the years, our listeners are used to me rambling off on one when I'm sort of halfway between awake and asleep. So stick with us, guys.
Because you've done Bradley Ray, so I was expecting you to move on to Luke Mossy.
Mm. Luke Mossy, what a season. It's the second half of the season has been really disappointing for the JG Speedfit Kawasaki man. He's moving on next season to where there are rumours, but until it's confirmed, it's difficult to say where he's going. It could be anywhere. He's staying in British Superbike, certainly. So we'll see where Luke Mossy ends up. Gino Rea, 14th, kind of expected a little bit more from Gino this weekend. He'd been there in the summer. They had the Brands Hatch round in the summertime, in the dry. They've got the data. They've got the settings that they need. So hard work for Gino. Michael Laverty, yeah, there's... I have an awful lot of time for Michael Laverty, but this season has been one to forget for him. The races were no better either, as we'll come to in short shift. So that was Q2, sort of elongated from my point of view, into Q1. And it was a ridiculously frantic Q1. The JG Speedfit team, they made changes to the rear shock for Leon Haslam. But unfortunately, he went slower than he did in Q2. So the changes that they made weren't as beneficial as they'd hoped. He went fastest, first of all. He was a mid-125 with Richard Cooper not far behind him. McKenzie went top. The time started to tumble. 125.3 for McKenzie. Then Dixon banged in a 124.9. McKenzie responded with a 124.8. And then Dixon smashed in a 124.6, which is a stunning lap around Brands Hatch GP circuit. Haslam was sixth at the time, had to really put in a lap to try and close the gap. But unfortunately, he ended up finishing eighth as Peter Hickman found a little bit of form this weekend, which is good to see Hickey back up at the sharper end. Your top nine in reverse order was Josh Brooks, Leon Haslam, Richard Cooper, having a great showing for the build-based Suzuki team. Peter Hickman, Tommy Bridewell, fifth place. He's had a new lease of life on that Moto Rapido Ducati. Never has hand in glove fitted so well. It would be interesting to see what he could have done there from the start of the season. If the listeners remember back to the start of the season, Moto Rapido started with Taylor McKenzie. Unfortunately, they parted company during qualifying at Knock Hill the week after Tommy Bridewell had parted company with Martin Halsall's team and Colin Wright. And then everybody got together after that Taylor McKenzie dropped back into stock 1000. Tommy Bridwell continued with Moto Rapido Ducati, and they've been as happy as Larry ever since. So it's been good to see Tommy get up there, because he's such a loose cannon in the fact that you never know what he's going to come out with on the grid, and B, what he's going to come out with on the track. So he really will mix it up, and he's not afraid to mix it up either. Andrew Ayer in fourth place. Great result for Andrew Ayrin and his last on his swan song for now with PBM Ducati. Taran McKenzie, one of the riders of the year for me, without a shadow of a doubt. The series rookie, third on the grid behind Glenn Irwin and a pretty rapid Jake Dixon. Although Irwin did actually get into the 124s as well, but 124.6. Around there, pretty special. It's exactly what Jake Dixon had to do. He got the pole position. Leon Haslam was eighth. Jake came out with a little thing after qualifying that he thought that Leon was struggling. I've seen something, and I believe that things aren't as they should be. They're under pressure, yada, yada, yada. So disappointed me a bit coming out like that with the mind games and with a 61-point lead, mind games are gone. Just get on there and ride your bike. If it was 3 or 4 points and it was a huge amount of pressure, then yes, it's all part and parcel of the sport these days. But with 61 points, I think Leon just shrugged and went, all I've got to do is finish behind you. It's not one has to win. If one wins, he wins it. If the other one wins, he wins it. It's not Hill and Hopkins. There's a yawning chasm between the two. So a little bit disappointed with Jake in that sense. Put your money where your mouth is. You've got it on pole. Now go and win the race, because that's what you've got to do if you want this championship.
I know what you mean. I think Dixon did exactly what he needed to do from the standpoint. He's like, he needed to come out and get first place. When I see stuff like that, I sometimes think this is just the PR guy at the back just finding column inches, ways to bait the media to get some press, to get some extra sponsorship.
Yeah, which in, at world level it probably would be. But at BSB, that was Jake.
It's all part of it. I think it's all water off a duck's back. These guys spend so much time in the paddock. I don't think it meant anything to Lee, and I don't think it meant anything to Dixon. But it's funny sort of watching give the press and the commentators something to squawk on about. Dixon, he turned up a weekend knowing full well that his only chance was to come out and, get pole position and start winning races and see him if Liam could, have a bad weekend or make any mistakes. I could see what he means a little bit when you think, like in Q3, not necessarily knowing that they went slightly the wrong way with the rear shock set up there, and just seeing that maybe Hansen's not quite posting the fast time, but then that all sort of changed as it came into race one, and actually saw where everybody's race pace was.
Yeah, and that's again, it's the Johnny Ray effect, isn't it? There's nobody at the level. Well, there is. That's unfair on Jake. Actually, that's disrespectful to Jake, and I don't mean that at all. When you look at Leon Haslam's season of consistency, he's going to be there or thereabouts. We talked about it at Silverstone. Even if he drops back to fourth, fifth, sixth place, he has a couple of tenths on the guys in front of him to be able to at least be fighting for the podium, and can control whereabouts on the racetrack he can be. And that was no more obvious than in race one for the weekend. And again, he was very animated on the grid, was Jake, before race one. But it's just his way of dealing with it. At the end of the day, he's still a kid. He's only 22. So I've got to cut him a little bit of slack, He is a very, very bouncy character. Talking to Ollie Rushby from MCN, who knows Jake really well. I don't know Jake personally. I've not met him. I've not interviewed him as yet. I've only sort of seen him about the garage when Jordan Weaving was riding with them. So I'm not looking at Jake on a personal level. It's just what I see and what I feel from being in the paddock over the years, and how he's just an effervescent, very confident character. It didn't come across as arrogant. That was the secret. He was a little bit cocky, but he wasn't arrogant. And you're looking, he's like, yeah, okay, fair enough. You've got to say what you've got to say. If that makes you feel better, then crack on. everybody's different, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure.
Everybody needs different ways to motivate themselves. Fogarty had to hate everybody, didn't he?
Exactly. I mean, that was his motivation. We've seen different. And I think sometimes too, you know, you've seen this with MotoGP, you know, for example, legendary, you know, Rossi's very friendly to people who aren't as quick as he is. But as soon as you get to be as quick as him, all the sort of fun and games and the nice smiles and the slapping of the back all seems to disappear.
And what else does he do? There's something really obvious that Valentino Rossi does. Once somebody gets faster than him, he doesn't refer to them by their Christian name anymore. He refers just to them by their surname. That's when you know you're off the Christmas card list.
It's these little things. I didn't see anything like that in the BSP paddock. And I know Jake is probably still bouncing and buzzing knowing that he's got a good Moto2 ride.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just purely my observations on it. It's nothing detrimental to Jake. It's just my observations on his actions, that's all.
And also too, I mean, this is no disrespect either to the RAF regular and reserves Kawasaki team as well, but you know, to see them up there being so competitive and having a rider that high in the standings as well, I mean, that is got to be a stellar banner year for them as a team.
Of course, yeah, for the Lee Hardy Racing team, yeah, RAF regular and reserves Kawasaki, they genuinely are, sorry Lee, punching above their weight. You know, the team have done a fantastic job this year. It's not all Jake, it's the team as a whole. And Glenn Richards, his input has been vital this year for Jake and for the team as a whole. They lost the Superstock rider prior to Brands Hatch. Jordan, he stopped riding for them. And he'd been injured most of the season. So they've only had the one bike most of the season to concentrate on. They haven't had diluted servicing with two bikes. It's just been a constant focus on Jake. Everything has revolved around him. They've given him everything he possibly needs. Kawasaki, I'm sure, have been in there and helped out, because I've seen not only is Lee wearing his own Lee Hardy Racing jacket, but he's also been bedecked in the Kawasaki top as well, which I'm sure means that he has Kawasaki, some support from Kawasaki, especially with Jake doing what he was doing. But they weren't a factory team. They are a privateer team, as well, in the same vein as Moto Rapido versus Paul Bird Motorsport. However, the bikes aren't too different, and the bikes aren't too different between Leon's Kawasaki and Jake's Kawasaki. Maybe a few differences, not cosmetic, but in parts, but in actual speed and races and ability of the bike, there's not much to choose between them, is there?
No, I don't think so. I think it starts to come down to the scope and depth of the personnel, the amount of data they probably have access to over the length of time that they've been racing. It's the smaller things, but he's still conscious that these teams are doing this kind of job on a fraction of the budget of these big brand name teams. And I thought it was a really stellar season, not just for the rider but for the team as well. And they went on to get a really good result in race one.
Absolutely, they did. I mean, Jake did his very, very best to take that win that he needed. But it was... who went off from the start? Let's have a look. It was...
Glenn Irwin. Glenn Irwin, straight from the start, wasn't it? It was pretty much into the lead. And yeah, and he ultimately took the win in race one. I think it was Jake Dixon, wasn't it, in second there? But
yeah, Jake Dixon in second. We lost a few people throughout the way. We lost Fraser Rogers on the opening lap. He put pay to Josh Elliott's race, unfortunately, early on. As he used Josh as a berm going into Graham Hill Bend, which smashed Josh's seat unit. But he did recover to 15th place after being 5 or 6 seconds down on the field. So a little shout out to Josh Elliott for that one, who will also feature in race two as well. It was a good race, but there was moments everywhere. Taz had a moment between Sheen and Stirling's that he looked like the flea on a dog's back at one point. He was just riding.
I think he had more than a moment. I mean, I watched him. He seemed to have a lot of... that was probably the biggest one, but there was a lot of, like, just little... bucks and twists and wiggles and stuff. I mean, you know, and he wasn't slowing down. He wasn't backing
off. Oh, no,
off.
He kept it pinned, didn't
another,
he, big time.
I mean, after the qualifying, it was another really impressive ride by him. He crossed the line in third, and you look back to see his teammate crossing the line in seventh. So, yeah, another very impressive ride by Taran.
At a circuit that Josh Brooks did the double on in the summer.
Yeah, earlier in the season.
So, something's gone awry there at Macam Yamaha for Josh Brooks this weekend. Yes, the weather's different, but the setting should pretty much remain the same. Unfortunately, Christian Iden's still struggling with his collarbone. He pulled out of the race, getting on towards mid-distance. Jason O'Halloran crashed out at Graham Hill Bend. It was then down to Dixon and Irwin that were battling away. Irwin got the better, so it ended up as a Ducati 1-2 with the brothers at the front of the field, which was great. Good to see, hoping they were getting embroiled in a battle, but unfortunately that didn't quite materialise as much as we wanted to. Danny Kent pulled in on lap 12 for the reasons I'm not quite sure. But again, he got some race distance in, which was good. So halfway round, it was Glenn Irwin, Andy Irwin, Jake Dixon, Taylor McKenzie, Hickey, and then Leon Haslam sat in sixth place. Again, as we said, consummate professional, knew what he had to do. I'm sure for those first few laps, he was riding really, really tight, knowing that he has a job to do. And there are maths involved, and he has to finish in a certain place. And he's been there before; he's got the experience. But I'm sure he was still just a little bit on the tight side for the opening few laps before Dixon got through on Andy Irwin. He seemed to drop back quite a bit from the leading two as Taz Mack went through as well on lap 19. It wasn't. The most exciting ever. It was a good race, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of tension. You were waiting for Leon Haslam to try and make a move, but he was playing it was more of a chess match for Leon Haslam and Jake Dixon. Jake knew what he had to do, Leon knew what he had to do. One of them didn't quite manage it, but the other one did, and was quite rightly, he'd won it in a regular season already. And then he'd finally won it in the showdown as well. So he's almost won the championship twice, in inverted commas. Congratulations to Leon Haslam and the JG Speedfit Kawasaki team. Pete Extance, all the guys there, Dave, Simon, all the guys, Paul, the guys that look after Leon, the team that they've got. Fantastic. At that point, they'd score points in every round.
Yeah, the consistency.
That consistency is incredible.
Not just of the rider, but of the team to field.
Absolutely, that's what I mean, for
a
everybody.
Over if you think about, you know, not just the races themselves, but over the whole weekend as well, having the bike available and up and running for the free practice, as well as the qualifying, you know, to ultimately get to the races.
Yeah.
As well, I mean, that is, I thought, a pretty amazing feat. And then, yeah, combine that with Haslam's consistency and his just raw pace. I mean, he just had a grip on this championship from early on. I know we lost Shane early on in the championship as well, but, you know, when you look back at the run Haslam's had, it would be difficult to honestly have seen Shane Byrne competing at that kind of consistency, at that kind of level.
Couldn't agree more. And as you say,
I think he may have been there or thereabouts.
Oh, yeah,
he'd have made it
harder for him, certainly. But ultimately, I think the planets had aligned beautifully for Leon this year, both with his crew, with his bike, and with his consistency, and with his own riding ability. He was the man this year, and that was right from day one. So it's been great for him to bounce back from what happened there last year, for the whole team and how they felt after what happened last year. Personal level, absolutely over the moon for my good friend Dave Hopkinson, who looks after Leon's bike for him, and for the whole team. I remember interviewing Pete Extance back in 2012 when I first started out dabbling with writing, when it was Primo Bournemouth Kawasaki with Chris Walker. So Pete's done a great job over the years. He's kept that consistency. He's built slowly. He hasn't come in and gone straight to the top. He's worked with James Hillier at the Isle of Man on a regular basis. They've brought youngsters on like Kyle Wilkes. They've brought, obviously, they've said James Hillier through. You know, they've had some good level riders, but they've always done the best of their ability every year, and they've worked and worked and worked until they can put this together. And putting it together with Lyon last season, where they were really unlucky in the final round, but nailing it this year, yeah, I couldn't be happy. I couldn't be more happy for the whole team. Nothing more than they deserve this year.
Agreed. And the nice thing was, it felt like you say, it was, you know, kind of a bit of a vanilla race, but had to happen, had to get that done. And I think with that done and everybody sort of breathing a sigh of relief, it really set, I know, the stage. It's sort of set it up now for just like two good fun races for the Sunday.
Yeah, the gloves were off, weren't they? Everybody could relax now. The only thing that really needed to be sorted out was the Riders' Cup, which became really interesting. I know it's even the riders are a little bit derisory about it. They have a bit of a laugh about, great, I came seventh and I get a trophy. Which is, the Riders' Cup is the best of the rest outside of the showdown. So it gives the other races something to look at. They get up onto the podium in front of the fans at the last round and they get a bit of trophy for it as well. And one thing that did make me smile and that I thought was a lovely touch, the first person to congratulate the guys at JG Speedfit Kawasaki was Glenn Richards. He was the first guy over there to congratulate Pete and all the team and be around the garage shaking everybody's hand. And I thought that was a really nice touch, a measure of the man that Glenn Richards is. But yeah, fantastic weekend, fantastic season. And go in for a full house of points across the season. You know, no DNFs. And that was the aim for the team after the championship had wrapped up. That something that... I was going to take the plaudits for this one, but I won't. I was having a look on Facebook this afternoon, and Dave Hopkinson was chatting with James Wright of Double Red, and James asked the question, has it been done before to get the full house? And Dave didn't know. He said he would have a look later. So I thought, okay, I'm in between jobs. I'll have a quick look on TSL timing, which is absolutely my Bible, both for this and across a race weekend with live timing and the session results, etc. And going back to 2002, as far back as the TSL timing results will go, nobody had done the full season of finishes, of points finishes. And the nearest one, the one that got closest, was Josh Brooks in 2015, his championship season, when I can see it now, he crashed at Brands Hatch and the very last race of the season. So he did 25 out of 26 races in the points.
Yeah.
Nobody had done that before. So that was a good target for the team across the weekend as well. But going back to the Riders' Cup, after that first race, McKenzie was on 163, O'Halloran on 152, 11 points back. I was looking at my maths. Yeah, that's about right. And Danny Buchan 147, Idden 143, Bridewell 138. Now,
yeah, because unfortunately Bridewell was one of the crashes, wasn't he, in race one?
He unfortunately crashed out of race one. He had it was him and who did he go down with? Richard Cooper.
Well, it was Cooper, wasn't it? Because initially I thought they tagged each other. But when the replay,
Haslam was in between
something
them
on the track, because yeah, they went down independently, but almost in exactly this on this touching the same piece of track.
Yeah,
they both just lost the front.
But luckily, not to take out Lyon Haslam at that point. As one crashes in front and one behind him,
you're like, in the middle there.
That's when you kind of know that it's going to be your day almost.
Yeah.
So that opened things up a little bit there, because Bridewell with a DNF, he was 25 points behind McKenzie at the end of race one. Now, unfortunately for Taz McKenzie, in morning warm-up on the Sunday, he crashed exiting Druids. And on the run down to Graham Hill Bend, the bike got into a bit of a tank slapper, threw him off, and he hit their air fencing quite hard and was unfortunately ruled out for the day with concussion. The bike was totaled. The team weren't going to get it ready for race one. So they were like, look, it's done. Your season's done. He was really disappointed, but when you take a crack on the head like that, one of the many good points of BSB safety record is that they're very, very protective of their riders, as protective as they can be, unless your name's Christian Idden and you just do what you want anyway. But certainly with head injuries, there's specific rules in place at BSB, and that's something I take my hat off to them for. They really do protect the riders, because they're racers. They'll go out and do it. Oh, it's fine. It's just a bit of a headache. I'll just go anyway. But like, they're like, no, you're done. Because you don't know, do you, with anything with head injury. If you take a bit of a... It looked fairly innocuous, but he hit the air fencing hard. So, and it was a bit of a snap on the neck. So he got up and walked away. He looked okay. And in his TV interview prior to race two, you know, he was okay, but he had got a bit of concussion, and that can affect you in a race later on. So he'd become then a danger to others. So hats off to BSB for the rules there, but certainly for Christian Iden, with a collarbone in two places... Still, after opening it up again in free practice, it was back to square one again where he was previously. So there's a huge amount of bravery for Christian Iden. But unfortunately, race two was wet, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to say. We should have said the Sunday, unfortunately, was wet. It was pretty miserable after the warm, dry weather we had on the Saturday. I'm sure it's one of those things that most of the riders, you know, sit up and just think, yeah, shit, I don't want to have to, especially two races, to have to get through this. But as, you know, as a spectator, getting to watch this from home, I'm always excited to see. And like a proper wet, not sort of that whole, you know, oh, could be a bit dry, could be a bit wet. I think it's just really, really nice to see.
None of that patchy malarkey.
Yeah, you know, they can just make, you know, it's all full wet. It's all full wet setup, you know, so you just have to sort of get on with it. I mean, unfortunately, race two wasn't too bad. I mean, it was damp, but it wasn't as bad as it did get later on.
No, they were all on full wet setup, weren't they?
But it was still a full wet setup, and it did throw up some really good racing for race two.
It's incredible. If you could see the notes that I have in front of me, the notes for race two, this just shows the level of excitement for race two. I have three sides of A4 of notes for for race two, and I'm not going to send everybody to sleep with all the notes. Just a ridiculous amount of passing. You know, it was... Out at the front, we had Andy Irwin, we had Jason O'Halloran, we had Jake Dixon, Leon Haslam, Tommy Bridewell. And they were all battling between themselves. And unfortunately, on lap three, Irwin exited stage right at Graham Hill Bend, which, you know, left the guys in, which left the boys at the front. It left O'Halloran and Haslam. Iden was then starting to push on with Dixon. Bridewell was your man that was causing a lot of problems in there. Just an incredible battle between them and the different manufacturers as well. Bridewell on the most...
Actually, speaking about Iden there, I think he was one of the few riders who probably was happy that it was wet. You know, with his broken collarbone, he knew that, you know, riding in the wet wasn't going to be as stressful or as physically demanding as riding in the dry.
No, but I did wince every time that back end stepped out. Because that must have wrenched it each time he did it. Obviously, yeah. BSB, no traction control in the wet. It's a war of attrition. You know, it's stand it up onto the fatter part of the tire and gently gas it as hard as you can. And again, as we've said previously, this was a race about getting to the finish as slow as you possibly can.
And it was some pretty tricky circuit to race on when it's wet. You know, we heard that, okay, part of the section is the Indy circuit, which is pretty slippery. So, you know, this was an area where they really had to tiptoe around before they got back onto the rest of the circuit where there was a little bit more grip.
And also it's autumn and it's surrounded by trees and there are leaves everywhere as well. Which it all has an effect, doesn't it? I mean, Yeah, I sat watching it again tonight, just before we came on air, so to speak. And normally, as I explained to you as we were having our little chat before we got started, no, I'll always watch the race as the race. I can't take notes while I'm watching the race because it would mean pausing and writing or just not concentrating too hard on what's going on and missing things. So I always watch the race as live, and then before the show I'll go back to it and it'll be pause, stop, pause, start, stop, forward, fast, that kind of thing, fast forward, whatever you want to call it. And I ended up watching almost the whole race at normal speed. There must have been 20 or 30 changes or more between those front five guys, between Bridewell, Haslam, O'Halloran, Dixon and Iden. And it just, I know the guys in the States won't get it until maybe two or three weeks, maybe more later. I don't know how that works with velocity and what if it's still on there even, or how the guys get it, because I know they can't get the YouTube links, I don't think. But as a flagship for BSB, what a fantastic race. Five riders, let's have a look, four different manufacturers: Ducati, Kawasaki, Honda, and BMW, which is a big plus point for BSB to have all of the four major manufacturers up there. Sadly, we're missing Yamaha from that point, and the Suzukis are building slowly but surely. So just some monumental passes. James Ellison, he came to the party sort of halfway through the race. He was banging in fastest lap after fastest lap. We lost Fraser Rogers, unfortunately. O'Halloran, he passed Bridewell into Paddock Hill Bend, and then Bridewell passed him back. James Ellison put in the fastest lap again on lap 9, pulling Richard Cooper along with him, who was sort of underlining his good weekend, apart from his disappearance from race 1 on the Saturday. Unfortunately, Gino Rea, he went down at Clearways. Now, you know, riders get frustrated. You know, Gino crashed at Assen a couple of times, and you could see he was clearly frustrated once he could unzip his leathers because his airbag's massive. He went down at Clearways, which is a really fast place to crash. Thankfully, it pushed him to the outside of the circuit. It was quite reminiscent of Michael Laverty crashing there in 2011, where Tommy Hill had to take avoiding action to miss his teammate. But thankfully, without injury, and thankfully without any issues for any following riders. When he got up, he was furious with himself, absolutely furious. But then he proceeded to kick the bike twice. Petulant little bugger.
Andrew Owen, when he went down sort of early on lap 3, I think obviously he'd fancied some chances as well, because he was pretty pissed off.
Yeah, but he was pissed off with himself. He didn't attack bike.
I mean, I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing. But yeah, it was pretty funny to see Gino Rea to sort of go after the bike. It kind of was a little bit reminiscent of Marquez sometimes, the way he'd come up and sort of plead with the bike as that Honda's front end would fold again. But yeah, Gino, I don't know, you know, what he felt. It was the issue with the bike. You know, I didn't see any interviews much after the fact. I mean,
there wasn't
a little thing on social media where he just basically said, it was my fault.
Yeah, so don't kick the bike then. If Colin Wright was his team boss, he'd have probably sacked him there and then. You know, it was almost a moment where you expect him to disappear off the side of the TV, off the side of the TV pictures, come back with a big branch and start. Right, that's it. Ladies and gentlemen, yeah. John Cleese. It was just that kind of thing. It was kind of funny, but kind of disrespectful to the bike and the team at the same time. If I was his mechanic, I'd make him bend over and I'd kick him as well. You know, you fell off, dude, not me. It wasn't the bike's fault. Set it up better. Harsh but fair. So we got to the point where Ellison was chasing down this group, and you're just like, commentator's curse. I almost disagreed with him at the time. With Jack Burnicle, he's like, Ellison's getting faster. He could win this. After the season he's had, I don't think so.
Well, even before then too, we were starting to see, you know, just sort of random people going out. I think just before Ellison went down, Laverty crashed.
Yes, he did
as well. And you know, we had Sterling's. Quite the DNF list, even by that standpoint. But yeah, Ellison, who had been, it sounds like he'd been making up the time by really pushing as he came off the Indy circuit onto the, what do they call it, international?
Onto the international circuit, on the GP circuit.
Where he was definitely finding more grip. He was able to push really hard there, but then just take it a little bit easier. I think was it out of Clearways as well?
No, it was Graham Hill Bend.
Was it Graham
Hill? Yeah, he just caught the guys at Graham Hill Bend, and I don't know whether he caught them quickly and he missed the line, because coming through Clark Curve and Clearways, I'm explaining this with my hands in true racer fashion, but you can't see this, and neither can the listeners. But imagine me sat on my couch in my lounge, and I've got both my hands doing the racer thing. B- because that's what we do when we talk about racing. Yeah. It's that, isn't it? It's he does that and he does that, and then he goes woo or whap if he grabs too much throttle. But I don't know if Ellison was unsighted, he got sucked into Paddock Hill Bend too fast, I don't know. But he'd made up all that ground. And often we see it, you go, he's got sector green. He's got, oh shit, where is he? You know, and he's pouring gravel out of his boot and his gloves. It's a fast place to crash. Again, 2014, I think, reminiscent then on the Milwaukee Yamaha. I've seen James do exactly the same thing in exactly the same place. But I don't know whether he was unsighted, whether there's a bump on the way in, how he managed to do it. But he caught the guys at such a pace down the front straight that maybe he just got sucked in a little bit fast. But yeah, that was the end of James Ellison's race. He'd put the fastest lap of the race in at that point. As you said, we'd lost Michael Laverty out of Stirling's, which is about to cap his difficult weekend. But it was at that point, Jake Dixon was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go for it. He put the hammer down. Dixon led from O'Halloran, Haslam, Bridewell, Iden. Cooper was on the back of the guys. But unfortunately, once he hit the front, Jake Dixon crashed out. You know, just coming into clearways, just about to tip in, lost the front, and the bike, Voldy, you can see why they have the catch fence in on the outside of clearways. Jake slid into the air fencing, thankfully not underneath it, because it's not a slow crash there. He's just on the brakes going into just prior to Clark Curve. There's two corners there. It's clearways and then into Clark Curve, which is, I think, the point just after the point of pit entry. So it's almost like a double point. You go in and then you go in again. So he was just tipping into that, lost the front. The bike goes off and kind of nearly takes out a poor marshal. Thankfully, the guys are paying great attention to what they are doing. But Jake slid, no injuries, just the bike was quite a lot secondhand. You could see the dash disappear off behind the tyre. Well, it must have reached, you know, a good 6 or 8 feet up the fence before it came to rest on top of the tyre wall.
Well, and I'd have to say that was my concern watching that, because the bike was literally somersaulting over the tyre wall and scattering the marshals every which way. I was really, really glad that none of them got caught up in that, because at least from the camera angle, I saw it like look pretty darn close. You sometimes forget, you know, the risks that some of these marshals do run to get these races run.
Yeah, the Orange Army are fantastic, and hats off to them for all the guys that have done the job this year, because for any race series, without the marshals, there ain't no racing.
And especially the Sunday, because it was pretty miserable to be stood out there.
We've had such a good year for it. We've had such a good year weather-wise. So, yeah, it's always take my hat off to the marshals. I'm friends with quite a few of the guys there and the girls and the taxi bikes as well. They do an amazing job. So to the guys that listen to the show from all of us at Motopod, thank you for everything you do through the year, to the medics, to the marshals, all the guys that give their time up for free. We couldn't do it without you.
Agreed. Thank you to all of them.
So Jake Dixon out of the race, that's the end of the attrition rate for race two, thankfully, which left it clear for Leon Haslam to take his first win around the Brands Hatch GP circuit. Tommy Bridewell, a solid second place ahead of Jason O'Halloran. Richard Cooper in fourth, a fairly broken Christian Iden in fifth. Peter Hickman getting back to the sharp end in sixth place. Glenn Irwin in seventh, Brad Ray in eighth, Josh Brooks ninth, which, you know, again, not where the McCams Yamaha wants to be. Big shout for Josh Elliott in 10th place, his best ever British Superbike finish. He rode the Tyco BMW last season a couple of times. He rode it at Snetterton and at Assen. Scored a couple of points in each of those outings. But a 10th place finish for Josh in the OMG Suzuki is fantastic, ahead of Luke Mossy, Mason Law, Sean Winfield and Aaron Zanotti in 14th place. But yeah, the list of it's, you know, it's half the field almost that didn't finish, and to finish first you have to finish.
Yeah, half of the interesting watch is not just the racing, but at any second, literally, as we saw with Dixon, Ellison, Laverty, you know, any of these could just sort of go out for seemingly next to no reason. So, yeah, it was a tough race because of that. And you're right, we did literally lose half of the field. And unfortunately, they had to get up a little bit later in the afternoon in worsening conditions and do it all over again for race three.
Yeah, they did. And with new livery for Leon Haslam as well. Very Keenan Sofowoglu in his livery for race three. Lots of gold flash-ins on the JG Speedfit Kawasaki. It looked great. But thankfully, especially for the length of Motopod, the race three was a little more placid affair, shall we say. Richard Cooper, he got the great start again from O'Halloran and Haslam. Bridewell pushing through to follow up his second place, which is his best result of the season in race two of the weekend for the Moto Rapido Ducati.
Allison unfortunately didn't get a good start from the front row, did he?
No, but he had issues on the sighting lap. He was looking at the rear on the sighting lap. So I think his race was run before the lights even went out. He just tried to make the best of it.
I don't know quite what the problem was, but I think you were right. After the bad start, he came round lap one. I think as he came past his pit board, he was sort of shaking his head at the mechanics.
And the amount of times he's shaking his head this year, I'm surprised he's still on his shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, and if that was his last race, there's been no announcement this weekend for James Ellison's future that I've seen.
Well, I agreed. So I've not heard any announcement, but I'm positive the commentators were sort of taking it as given that he'd be back for next year.
That's my opinion. That's my opinion. There hasn't been an official, there wasn't anything on the TV. There was no presentation. There's no big, you know, if you think a man who's done over 250 BSB race starts, I think. I'm sure that he was one of them that had done over 250 race starts. It's in my notes somewhere, but I can't remember. But he's done a shitload anyway.
It's a pretty firm fan.
He's got a really good fan base. And, you know, he's been there or thereabouts in the championship every year that he's raced, apart from when he disappeared off to MotoGP with PBM. Now, you would have thought there would have been something, had that been his last race, to say thank you very much, some presentation, lobbing his gear into the crowd, and, you know, at least giving him a bit of a send-off. I know it's been a pretty shit year by James Ellison's standards, and he's not happy with the year, and it's difficult to celebrate something that you haven't enjoyed. But from a fan's perspective, I figured there might have been something, but there wasn't, which all points to me that he's coming back next year.
Yeah, like I said, that was what I took away from listening to, like, the commentary. They just seemed to say, oh yeah, well, you know, sort of better luck next year. And the hope is that he will be able to stick with the Olins, which clearly has started to work better for him.
He'll stick with Olins, but I don't think he'll stay with Anvil Hire Tag.
Do you not? Okay. Yeah, so then I have no idea. We'll just have to see where I think I was taking it, that he would still be back with them for next year.
But if I were a betting man, after the season he's had, I don't think he will stay. And if you think that the spaces at Tyco BMW, there could be a space at Smith BMW if Sylvain Barrier isn't retained. You know, the space at Honda, which I'm not too sure that he would end up there. But there are other seats available in the paddock if he fancies a change of scenery and a control alt delete kind of scenario.
Yeah, we'll have to see how he goes. But yeah, unfortunately, his last race there didn't go particularly well. You know, on the front row, but yeah, that bad start, and then didn't get much better during the race, because I think ultimately did he retire or did he go down? I can't remember.
I'm 100% sure he retired.
He retired, pulled in and retired, yeah. Well, unfortunately, one of the early fallers was Mr. Laverty again.
Yeah, what a weekend.
What a miserable weekend for him. I mean, it was pretty miserable weather, miserable conditions. I mean, even the cameras were having a hard time seeing through the mist and the haze and everything. But, yeah, I think I didn't quite see the crash, but it looked to be like onto the straight, just the back went and flipped him off.
Yeah, it was on the hill up the little rise up out of Stirling's, onto that where they come down under the bridge and they drop down to Hawthorns. It was the very start of that where you get the great photographer shots from as you look back up the track from the left hand side, where the bikes are all crossed up, the guys are hunched over the front trying to keep it down, and you know, there's some spectacular photos from across the weekend over social media. Such a brilliant...
And there was actually a pretty scary moment because he ended up crashing, landing on the track, like you're right, just over the back of that ridge,
yeah, unsighted
over the back
of
that
for
rise.
The guys coming, yeah.
So he was very quickly to, even lying down, to try and get a hand in the air to try and help riders coming over that rise see him as quickly as possible. Thankfully, able to get to his feet and get off the track without incident. But yeah, pretty frightening, like I say, last race, and I just think he'd be good riddance with that season.
Yeah, he was, and that was his opening. I think that was the end of, was that halfway through lap two, wasn't it? That was early.
Yeah, lap two.
Very,
yeah.
Very early. But again, in commentary, they reckon that that was Michael's swan song race from BSB anyway, and that he was heading to World Endurance.
Yes, that's what I've heard, World Endurance as well.
So, you know, again, nothing to say cheerio and thanks very much, but maybe that'll be announced as part of his, because he's done World Endurance this year with Christian Iden, hasn't he, with a fair amount of success.
Exactly.
Maybe the prize money is a little bit more, maybe the wages are a little bit different, you know, and it's less rounds. Are there only 8 rounds of World Endurance, something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think each individual race is more stressful, but I think you're right, there's less of them, probably less travel time.
Which can then fall in nicely with his work with BT.
Yeah,
with BT
actually,
Sport
that'd be great.
For
MotoGP.
I'd love
to see him continue commentating because he's been. I'd love seeing riders, but he's been particularly good.
He has, and so has Shane Byrne, and both of them together have been really, really good in their respective fields at BSB and at MotoGP. So, and they are relevant riders, and that's no disrespect to anybody who's doing it now, whether it's not James Toseland, Neil Hodgson, all riders at all levels are very, very good. But these guys have done it the most recently.
Yeah. But as the race early on in for the rest of the race of race three, it was Richard Cooper on the Suzuki, on the build base Suzuki, who essentially was into the lead and pulled a gap, pretty much kept it for the rest of the race.
Didn't he just? You know, and he held it well. Richard Cooper's a good rider. I know one of our long-term listeners, Peter Newell over there in San Francisco, he's an admirer of Richard Cooper. He's kept an eye on him for quite a while now. So that'll put a smile on Peter's face, I've no doubt. And you know, Coops is a good rider. He's been around a while now. He's an ex-Stock 1000 champion. It's just getting the right ride for him. And to finish the season in this sense, and he's without a ride for next season so far. He's out at Build Base Suzuki. That place I expect to be taken by Billy McConnell, who I believe in his contract, if he finished first or second, he was telling me at Cadwell that he would get the Superbike ride for next season. So I expect Billy to be alongside Bradley Ray for next season. But Coops hasn't done himself any harm with that ride this weekend. There's still some, as we said, some seats left to be filled in BSB. So hopefully we'll see him back in the series next year and not have to drop back down to back across to Stock 1000 for sure. Excuse me while I turn my page onto the next page. But again, there was still plenty of passing going on. There's still plenty of battles with the rain. Everybody was getting a twitch. Everybody was losing the rear at some point. There was massive slides coming out of Graham Hill Bend. Leon Haslam had a huge one coming out of Druids. It almost looked as if it was across. I couldn't work out if it was. I don't think there was a white line across it, but maybe a bit of tarmac banding. Whereas just as you traverse from the right side of the tyre to the left, which is exactly what happened to Taron McKenzie in morning warm-up on the Sunday, a big, big slide for Leon Haslam, but also plenty of slides coming through Clearways and Clark Curve, which were caught on the high motion camera. Did you catch those?
I did. You get someone who's just like having fun.
Yeah,
you know, that just seemed to be, you know, something where he could really control and manage it and was just having fun with it. It was the sort of progressive slide where you could control it on the throttle and not the sort of the snap twitch.
I am Ty Woffenden.
That you'd see somewhere else. So, yeah, I mean, it made excellent, epic viewing. I love, you know, seeing stuff like that as well. So that was good fun to see. But I thought initially that big twitch, I thought like, oh, you know, from Haslam's standpoint, with everything that he's done, that he'd just sort of sit back. But he carried on having pretty good fights there with Dixon as well before Bridewell got away to chase down Cooper at the front.
Which is another fantastic ride from Tommy Bridewell. I've been a fairly strong critic of Tommy over the years. It's just not a rider I've particularly gelled with. But seriously, seriously impressed with Tommy Bridwell this weekend. And
well, to get good results in the dry and in
exactly
the wet.
Exactly that. You know, he's been there or thereabouts in the top five or six ever since he made the switch to Moto Rapido Ducati. So, it's not a fluke that he's doing what he's doing. Unfortunately, Josh Elliott, he asked for the power at Stirling's and unfortunately it flicked him out the front door uninjured. Cooper, Bridewell, Dixon, Haslam, Iden and Brooks by half distance. There's a great battle further back with Andy Irwin, Sylvain Barrier, Danny Kent getting up into the points ahead of Bradley Ray. Who'd have thought that the Household Racing Suzuki would be ahead of the factory-backed build-based Suzuki of Bradley Ray. Christian Iden, he pushing on, he passed Haslam into Hawthorns. Haslam bit back. And then it was two in and fro in. Brooks then got onto the back of it. He back of the chasing group. He passed Leon Haslam into clearways. Just as the laps ticked down. Richard Cooper taking the checkered flag, fully deserved, ahead of Thomas George Bridewell II, to give him his full moniker. A full 7.5 seconds ahead of Tommy Bridewell, with Jake Dixon in third. Christian Iden, a heroic fourth place with the collarbone in the shape it's in. Josh Brooks salvaging something from the weekend, just half a second back from Christian Iden. Leon Haslam, a safe sixth place, completing the clean sheet of point scoring finishes across the season. Hats off JG Speedfit Kawasaki and Leon Haslam. Gino Rea equaling his season best finish for OMG Racing Suzuki in seventh place, ahead of Jason O'Halloran, Peter Hickman, Sylvain Barrier, Bradley Ray, Danny Kent in 12th place, ahead of Mason Law, Sean Winfield, Aaron Zanotti. Now, over on my alter ego of Paddock Chatter on Twitter, I put a little tweet out at the start of the weekend about Danny Kent. So, the variables are such that we can't really get a handle on how Danny's going to do. But don't be surprised to see him finish in the points this weekend. And one person in particular scoffed at me for making that statement. And you just sit back, and I haven't replied to him, I haven't got it, but it was always going to be a possibility. And I'm chuffed for Danny. It's given him hopefully it's given him a shot in the arm. Hopefully it's given him a chance for next season. But ultimately, look at Scott Redding coming in for 2019 on that V4 Ducati. For Danny to make that transition and to finish in the points in his first weekend. Yes, he had two DNFs, but he brought the bike home. They weren't crashes. Then it opens the door for Scott Redding to be on that factory PBM Ducati with a full winter of testing. For me, he's going to hit the ground running next season.
You're right. I think coming in with our season's testing, the opportunity to get used to that. I thought, Danny to finish in 12th on, a superbike with no traction control in the wet, on wet tyres, talk about things he'd not done before. I know you could argue that, okay, there was people retiring and crashing out and whatnot. But anyway,
so what?
I still thought that that was pretty impressive. Yeah, and I agree. I think for next year. I also think, too, there's a lot of riders in the paddock who are just gagging to benchmark themselves off a MotoGP rider as well, to sort of prove what they can do. And I love it when you have riders coming in from different series, so you can start to, in the pub after a couple of pints, start to draw comparisons between the different series and therefore between all the different riders and everything. I just, it starts to pull all this thing together, all the different championships together. I don't know, it just makes the whole thing just that much more exciting and interesting.
And what it'll also do is raise the profile of the series, but bringing those guys in, and Danny Kent's no mug on a bike, Scott Redding is certainly no mug on a bike, and it will show the level of British superbikes if they have to fight for. I don't expect Scott Redding to come in and wipe the floor with everybody. His teammate for sure is going to be a massive, massive threat, and it'll be interesting to see who makes the number one rider status there. Whether I think on wages, probably Scott Redding, but on results early season, I'd put my money on Josh Brooks to start with. Just a little bit of news on that front as well, as we haven't quite got to that part yet. Josh Brooks is confirmed at PVM Ducati alongside Scott Redding. Danny Buchan stays where he is at the FS3 Kawasaki team. Joe Francis, he gets a full season with PR BMW. He's done the last three rounds with those guys for the young Cheshire rider. Big, big talent. Good learning curve for Joe Francis. Looking forward to see how he goes. And he's just a really good lad as well. Potentially, there were rumours at the weekend that Shaky could make a comeback if his neck is past fit at his scan in November. He put a tweet out asking Steve Moore at Moto Rapido to build a second bike for him to partner Tommy Bridewell. And he said, yeah, he said, I'm up for that. So, and I heard from Ollie today from MCN, it's more than just bravado, by all accounts. It's a serious possibility. It's not just Shaky making the weekend about him. There is a possibility for that. And then Superstock 600 champion Ryan Vickers, we mentioned him a couple of shows ago. He's going straight into British Superbike from Stock 6. He is taking Jake Dixon's berth at Lee Hardy Racing at Royal Air Force Regular and Reserves Kawasaki. So that will be a learning curve and a half for young Ryan Vickers, but one that we will follow on the show next season.
Yeah, and talking about the Moto Rapido, with the second place that Tommy Bridewell took in race three, I think that confirmed him as the winner of the Riders' Cup with 178 points ahead of Jason O'Halloran.
Considering he was 12th at the start of the weekend, it was a massive turnaround.
Also a good, I think it was a good weekend for Tara McKenzie as well. Chris Nidden now is off to the doctors to get that collarbone plated and fixed. So hopefully he can start his recuperation and get back fitness training to come back for next year all fit and well.
Yeah, very much so. I think he was the one that ended the season, I think, in the most pain along with Dan Linfoot. But it hasn't been, thankfully, a season of too many injuries across the championship, if I remember right. Dan Linfoot's taken most of them with his scaphoid and his neck prior to that. So I think, unfortunately, Dan Linfoot soaked up all of the injuries for the rest of the field, apart from obviously Christian Iden and that damn collarbone of his. So a safe season for all. The lack of DNFs did it for Leon Haslam. The consistency was phenomenal. He ended the season 699 points, which is 70 points ahead of Jake Dixon. So a pretty yawning chasm in the end. One of the most comprehensive victories we've seen in a long, long time. As we said before, not since 2002, as the records that I've got access to go back as far as anybody has finished as consistently across the season as Leon Haslam. Glenn Irwin sealed third place. Josh Brooks was fourth. Excuse me, Peter Hickman fifth, Bradley Ray was sixth, and as you rightly say, Tommy Bridewell at the death, stealing that Riders' Cup championship from Jason O'Halloran by just 2 points. Well ridden, Tommy Bridewell. Well done, Steve Wilfmore. Well done to all the guys in the championship. It's been a fantastic season. I've loved being back on Motopod to discuss it all. Hopefully all the guys are still awake out there. Hopefully you enjoy the BSB coverage. You can tell how much we enjoy it. If we can carry that on for next season, then fantastic. If you guys are enjoying it, then we'll continue, because I could sit and talk about it until the cows come home. Andrew?
Agreed. I really enjoyed it as well. It was great to sit down with yourself and actually have some more insider knowledge from your time in the paddock, being at the races and being at the different events. I think once the MotoGP stuff wraps up and we have a little bit more time in the Motopod schedule, we'll be able to sit down and plan a little bit of a review show and also a look ahead to the 2019 season as well. And I know Harry has said this from once or twice, but I genuinely think next year could be one of the best seasons ever.
Best ever. Before I go, I'd forgotten about that. we will do a review show, I'm sure, and we will look at the support classes in that a little more in depth. before Christmas, and we'll look to maybe do something a little more on the support classes next season as well. Because I know the guys, you guys who follow BSB that listen in, it's not just about BSB. You enjoy Stock 6, you enjoy Stock Thou. The Super Sport has been pretty epic racing this year. MotoStar's been a bit of a one-horse race a little bit, but there's some good young talent coming through there. Jake Archer moves on. There's Asher Durham in there. We've mentioned Thomas Strudwick before. What Thomas does next year, we don't know, but he wrapped up second in the standard class behind Victor Rodriguez this weekend. So there's an awful lot of talent in the British paddock, and you know, if we can cover that as much as possible next season, we've already congratulated the guys who wrapped up their championship prior to this weekend. But massive congratulations to Jack Kennedy, who wrapped up the Supersport Championship this weekend ahead of Ben Curry, to Keith Farmer, who wrapped up the Stock 1000 Championship for a second time ahead of Billy McConnell. That's a race and a championship that's worthy of a discussion on its own. We do like the Stock 1000 Championship. Eunan McGlinchey, he wrapped up the Supersport 300 title. And I'm going to let Paul Napton down because I didn't look to see who won the Sidecar Championship. We will cover that in this little season review when we get a chance after the close of the MotoGP season.
And then for this weekend, we have the MotoGP coming up at the Twin Ring Motegi in Japan. And then, as we mentioned, the weekend after that, 25th, 27th of October, will be the final round of World Superbikes in Qatar. Well, Dave, thanks very much indeed for your time.
A pleasure. Hopefully the listeners are still awake.
To our listeners, thank you very much for sticking with us through the show. Dave, thanks again. Have a good evening.
A pleasure. And to you and to the listeners, thank you very much indeed. Zoom, zoom.